This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. What if there was a food as nutritious as kale that also helped fix the problem of ocean acidification? Scientists and growers say that's exactly what kelp is. They're working on turning kelp farming into both an economic and an ecological boon for the Gulf of Maine. While we're talking about Maine, two NASA employees are naming Mars after New England's vacation land. We'll hear why later this hour. Also, technological advances in wastewater treatment and the future of septic systems on Cape Cod. First, though, we check in with our friends at the Nature Podcast to get a taste of some of this month's top science headlines. Joining me now is co-host Adam Levy. Adam, good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you.
All right. So last week's budget deal largely avoided the kind of deep cuts to government science agencies that President Trump had been proposing. Nonetheless, the National Institutes of Health is proposing capping how much grant funding any individual researcher can actually get. If it's not just pure budget concern, what's driving this?
Yeah, so it doesn't seem that this is driven by purely budget concern. It's something that they've been talking about for quite some time, and that's kind of sharing out the money a little bit more evenly. At the moment, just 10% of grant recipients win 40% of the agency's research money, and those grant recipients tend to be the scientists who've been doing research for years and years and are very well practiced. But the agency, the NIH, are now saying, well, what about the younger researchers with new, fresh ideas? We want to make sure that they're also getting a little slice of the grant research money.
So this is really much more about social issues and kind of fairness within science.
Yeah, exactly. That seems to be the idea. And it's something that NIH have been talking about for long before Trump, although different ideas to redistribute the money than this one. It's finally getting implemented now.
All right. Antibiotic resistance is a growing problem. These are infections that just don't respond to the antibiotics we currently have. It's a really challenging problem for a number of reasons. But Nature just had a story about one factor that's holding back progress that is totally surprising, at least to me. It's vocabulary, the way people are talking to each other about this issue. What's going wrong?
Yeah, so this was a comment piece from a few doctors and practitioners. The lead author was Mark Mendelsohn. And what they were arguing is that the language we use can really hold back science. An example in a different field is when we talk about climate change. Now, research has shown that if we talk about policy to fight climate change, people won't care as much as if we talk about policy to fight global warming. So these terms we use can have a massive effect on how we see a problem. And in the case of antibiotic resistance, a lot of people don't actually know the terms that are commonly used. Commonly, researchers talk about antimicrobial resistance, a term that nearly half of respondents didn't recognize, it's often abbreviated to AMR. Barely anyone knows what AMR is.
I mean, as science communicators, we're forever asking scientists to pay attention to their language and make sure they're not speaking in jargon when they address the public. The stakes aren't usually quite as high, though, as when you're talking about this. I mean, as you said, AMR makes no sense to most people.
No, absolutely. The stakes are really high. This is literally a matter of life and death, the fight against antibiotic resistance. And what this team are proposing is that we talk about drug-resistant infections. They reckon that'll be a much clearer term for people to understand.
All right. Another really intriguing story. Researchers have apparently had some success treating PTSD using MDMA, speaking of acronyms. This is the drug commonly known as ecstasy or Molly. And apparently this could be getting close to FDA approval. So how effective is this treatment?
Yeah, so it's just finished. Results have just come out from phase two trials. And what they found is 67% of participants who were being treated for PTSD responded positively, compared to just 23% in the control group who didn't receive MDMA. So just before anyone who might have PTSD or be worried about that kind of thing goes out and thinks they're going to try and buy some Molly in a club to try and treat their problem, this wasn't just giving people this drug. It was giving them this drug in combination with therapy.
And I mean, that's pretty amazingly effective. Do we have any idea how it's working, how it's doing this?
Studies suggest that MDMA reduces the fear response and can make people feel more open, a better sense of well-being. And when you're dealing with traumatic events, and remembering those traumatic events can bring back new trauma, it's very difficult to have therapy. MDMA enables you to potentially remember those events in a way that isn't painful, and so learn new ways to deal with them.
Is this kind of a chronic therapy? Are we talking about people suffering from PTSD who would be on Molly constantly, who are constantly going to be a little bit high to deal with PTSD, or is this a more episodic kind of treatment?
No, it's definitely not you kind of take Molly once a week for the rest of your life. It's very much just for a set of therapy sessions, and then the idea is that that therapy might help lift you out of this state of post-traumatic stress disorder.
All right, that's definitely one we're going to have to follow. Finally, new evidence that North America may have been inhabited for 10 times longer than previously thought, that in fact the earliest North Americans may have been Neanderthals 130,000 years ago. What's the new evidence?
So the evidence is actually from 1992. What's new about it is the date. But what was dug up was some mastodon bones in California and some rocks. So not actually human remains. But what's interesting about these mastodon bones is they look, at least to the researchers, like they were smashed up very deliberately. And the researchers themselves can't think of another plausible explanation for what could have done this other than humans.
So, I mean, how significant is this, the difference between 15,000 years ago and 130,000 years ago? That's a big difference. But how much of a difference in our understanding of what was really happening on this continent does it make?
So if it's true, it's a huge difference. A lot of researchers have explicitly referred to it as a potential game changer, a whole new chapter in our understanding of human migration across the world. But a lot of researchers have also expressed a lot of skepticism. Donald Grayson, who's at the University of Washington, told BuzzFeed, "I was astonished, not because it is so good, but because it is so bad." So there's a lot of skepticism out there. But then at the same time, there are other researchers who say they were skeptical at first and then they read the study and couldn't think of any more plausible explanation than humans.
So yet another story to keep an eye on. Adam Levy is co-host of the Nature podcast. He and his colleagues join us each month for a look at some of the top science stories out there. Adam, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We now turn to a lighthearted story that caught our eye here at Living Lab Radio. NASA is working hard to send humans to Mars in the next couple decades. If any Maine residents are among those interplanetary explorers, they should feel right at home. That's because two NASA scientists have been naming landmarks on Mars for, yes, their favorite places in Maine. There's Ogunquit Beach, Lobster Mountain, and, of course, Bar Harbor. Full disclosure, we did not find this story on our own. We read it in the Boston Globe, and I just had to talk with one of the scientists myself. So I'm happy to say that joining me now from her home in Brunswick, Maine, is R. Eileen Yingst. She's a senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute and a deputy principal investigator on the Curiosity rover's selfie camera called the Molly camera. Dr. Yingst, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, how on earth, or maybe I should be saying how on Mars, did you ever get the idea to name places on Mars after places in Maine?
We have to name features, objects, targets so that we can easily refer to them among the team members. And so we have certain rules that allow us to pick groups of names so that we can quickly go to that name group depending on where we are. We mapped the area from orbit, from orbital images, before we ever landed, and we cut them up into little one-kilometer squares to give each person, you know, three or four squares to make it easy to do. And so each of those squares is named after a geologic formation that shares the name of a small town. So there is a Hanover Quad, there's a Chelmsford Quad, and there's a Bar Harbor Quad, and that's where that name came from.
I mean, you said these are names you come up quickly for your team to be able to refer to these different areas. Are these formal names that are going to stick?
The names are currently informal, meaning that they haven't gone through the official process of being approved by the International Astronomical Union. There are so many, though, and we use new ones every day, so you can see why we don't have time to get them approved every time we use them. However, these names are already being used in publications, so I don't see them being changed anytime soon.
You've got Squid Cove, Lobster Mountain, Old Soaker, Gunkwit Beach, all on Mars, as well as in Maine. I mean, do the places on Mars bear any semblance to the places in Maine? Is Gunkwit Beach actually some sort of beach or former beach on Mars?
It's not a beach, and oftentimes there's no connection. It just happens to be, you know, it's the next one on the list, or it's a name that somebody really likes, or it's a name that someone is attached to. But sometimes, yes, and in the case of Gunkwit Beach, we're in a very sandy area. So Gunkwit Beach is actually in an area that is between a dune called the Desert of Maine and another place that has a beach or a sand name attached to it. So we do occasionally try and have our names make sense.
You must know that there's actually a Mars Hill in Maine. Have you ever thought about using that, or is that just way too circular to have a Mars Hill on Mars that's named after Maine?
It's actually on the list for sure.
Do you ever kind of stop and think about the history of human migration that is kind of encapsulated in these names? I think about places like Yarmouth, Maine, that are named after a place in England, and now we're exporting that to Mars. Gunkwit, a Native American name that was kind of appropriated. There's a lot in these names, and we're adding to that now by sending it to Mars.
Absolutely. Many of us are planetary scientists, because we couldn't join Starfleet. We couldn't go out and explore ourselves, so we have to do it through avatars. And so we very much feel like explorers taking the human condition and the human attitudes and creativity and so on along with us. And we're very cognizant of the fact that we're doing this work, we're doing this science, for the taxpayers of the United States and for the rest of the world. And so we're very careful and we're very cautious with our resources, but we're also, we hope to bring along that sense of exploration and excitement and in seeing new things and trying new things and pushing our limits as far as we can.
What are some of the coolest features or places on Mars that you've gotten to name so far?
That's a hard question to answer because I work on Mars and everything is cool. There is nothing that is not cool, right? Has been enjoying the beautiful Native American names, the Wabanaki names in particular, and being the person that people go to have them pronounced. We just a couple of sols ago named something Cabasakanti Lake. And there was a lot of, Eileen, how is this pronounced? Eileen, can you say it again? Eileen, how is it? How does it go? It's just like it's spelled, Cabasakanti. Okay. So that's actually something I really enjoy while we're going through this particular area of Mars.
Is there a particular place name in Maine that you haven't gotten to use yet that you personally are kind of dying to use and just waiting for the right landmark on Mars?
Androscoggin. I'm waiting for Androscoggin because I live on the Androscoggin River.
And what would be the right kind of feature to call Androscoggin?
I don't know if there's a right feature. It would be a feature where we'd have to use the name a lot.
That's our Eileen Yingst. She's a senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute and a deputy principal investigator on the Curiosity rover's selfie camera called the Molly camera. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Heather Goldstone. Up next, efforts to jumpstart a kelp farming industry in the Gulf of Maine. We want to hear from you. Do you eat kelp? Or what would it get you to try? What would it take to get you to try it? Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Find out if kelp is the new kale when Living Lab continues after a short break.